supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. All eight candidates for District Attorney of Philadelphia took part in a forum today sponsored by the Business Association of West Parkside. Former prosecutor Joe Kahn said the new DA must restore trust and confidence in the office.
I think that one of the best ways we can do that is by showing that we are not about seeking convictions, we are about seeking justice.
All the candidates spoke more about justice and fairness than being tough on crime. They focused on the need to get low-level drug offenders into treatment rather than prison and reform a bail system that seems burdensome to poor defendants. One candidate, civil rights attorney Larry Krasner, said his rivals are new to progressive ideas, while he says he's embraced them for decades.
The fact is that if you need reform, you need a real reformer. And I am the one who, when it was unpopular and unprofitable, represented ACT UP, represented protesters at the RNC, represented Occupy.
The other candidates are Republican Beth Grossman and the other Democrats, Rich Nagrin, Michael Undermeyer, Tariq Al-Shabazz, Jack O'Neill, and the only woman in the Democratic field, former municipal court judge Teresa Carr Denny. Now, in the next of his series of interviews with the candidates for DA, WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies speaks with Judge Denny. She's a Temple Law School grad who spent several years in private practice before running successfully for judge in 1995. She resigned last year to run for district attorney.
Well, Judge Teresa Carr Denny, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for inviting me today.
20 years on the bench, you did preliminary hearings for major felony cases, you tried a lot of cases, so you saw the district attorney's office come in day after day. What's one thing that needs to change?
I think the attitude of going for the juggler is not necessary, and some come in with that as their MO, and I think that is one thing that definitely needs to change. People in criminal justice today are maybe even a little closer to social workers because of things like the opioid crisis and the untreated mental illness in our city. And there are just programs that fit some of these situations that we have to educate ourselves about, make ourselves aware of, develop new programs, and direct those with low-level, nonviolent crimes into programming so that they are not return customers.
One of the things I've heard talking to others about this is that the current diversion programs begin with a criminal case, and then a judge says, you're going to go to treatment. If you stick with it, if you do your urine tests and the monitoring, you can avoid a criminal conviction. A lot of people don't make it. Addicts, kicking addiction is hard. So we end up paying for that treatment and then putting them in jail anyway. We need a whole new system. Do you agree?
I agree, and I'm also my position on this is evolving as we speak because initially I thought, I think along with a lot of other people, that sobriety was the goal. However, I've come to understand that when there's a drug addiction of any substantial time, that the brain may be rewired and may require medication. So medication-assisted treatment is becoming more the avenue that's looked at to make sure that people don't come back.
There's a very controversial program of civil asset forfeiture in which the district attorney's office will seize assets of people suspected of crimes, sometimes never convicted, sometimes never charged. It's under legal challenge. What's your view of that practice?
I think it is wrong. I think it's immoral. And I think that this is where prosecutorial discretion is very important. We are taking homes from people whose relatives might be exchanging a bag of weed in front of their house, and they don't even know about it. And before anybody's even convicted, the home is being seized. And it's just on its face. It's unfair, and it's got to stop.
How do you feel about the way the office has handled police misconduct cases? Is there a need for change there?
Police in Philadelphia are a step above what we've seen in other cities. So I don't think there's a great amount of police misconduct. I think the police, with the prior commissioner subjecting the department to a federal review, and the current commissioner having satisfied almost all of the conditions that were requested, I think we should have more confidence in our police in Philadelphia, that they want to do the right thing, and most of them are trying to do the right thing. There's always going to be a few bad apples, and then they have to be dealt with.
What's your view of the death penalty?
I will not take the death penalty off the table. I think it should be reserved for the most heinous crimes, but I am not going to invite a terrorist into this city with some guarantee that they will not face the death penalty. I will not, as a practice, go for it just because it can happen under the guidelines. But in an appropriate case where discretion allows it, I will go for it.
You were, before you became a judge, a counsel for the Democratic Party. The party's very influential in elections like this, and there are those who say we shouldn't have ward leaders picking our judges or prosecutors. And I'm wondering what your view is of whether it's healthy for politicians to be involved in this process as much as they are. You know, some people see them as hacks doing favors for each other. What's your view of the party?
I don't see them as hacks at all. I see them as community leaders, and they are not the sole community leaders that help select the candidates that get elected. So I think they get a bad rap. Of course we want this party support. It's a party system. I'm running as a Democrat. I want the Democratic Party support. But I'm not getting any head start because I was their attorney. Believe me, I would have to earn this. I have to work for it just like everybody else.
Judge Teresa Cardenai, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me here. Thank you.
In Berks County, four children who've been in federal immigration detention for a year and a half have drawn the attention of Amnesty International. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports the minors all have visas to stay in the country legally, and the advocacy group is petitioning for their release.
Antonio, Carlos, Josue, and Michael are between 3 and 17 years old. Those aren't their real names. They are the pseudonyms Amnesty International is using. All have what's called a special juvenile immigrant visa, says their attorney, Bridget Cambria.
So to qualify for a special immigrant juvenile visa, you have to be deemed abandoned, abused, or neglected by a parent in your country. And it also has to be found by a court that it's in your best interest to remain in the United States.
With that visa, the boys are in line to get green cards. The four fled gang violence in Central America with their mothers, who are detained at the Berks Family Residential Center about 70 miles from Philadelphia. 33-year-old Lorena, not her real name, says she doesn't know what to tell her 4-year-old son when he asks when they're leaving.
Many days he's saying, Mom, let's get out of here. I don't want to be here. And the answer to let's go is, I can't give you an answer because I don't know when we can leave.
Special immigrant juvenile status doesn't extend to the mothers, who have their own pending immigration claims. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials declined to comment on specific cases. Justin Mazzola with Amnesty International says they want to raise awareness of the long detentions at Berks because they fear there will be more cases like this under President Donald Trump.
What we're concerned about is that a policy that was used by the Obama administration of using detention as deterrence is going to basically be exacerbated and expanded.
Trump's executive orders on immigration call for increased detention near the southern U.S. border. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Every day, immigrants living in the United States illegally line up at federal buildings across the country to check in. It's how the government keeps track of those with deportation orders who are not considered threats. But as WNYC's Matt Katz explains, that policy may be changing.
Harry Pangemanan was never all that handy, but after Sandy hit, he volunteered along the Jersey Shore. He learned how to hang drywall and put in a bathroom. From there, Pangemanan helped to rebuild some 200 homes. He walks me through a 90-year-old house he just fixed up in Keyport.
We put also the new ceramic tiles down, and then we replaced the whole kitchen cabinets.
The community came out to mark the completion of construction with a blessing.
Thank you, God.
Pangimanan, who lives in Highland Park, New Jersey, runs a church nonprofit that does this kind of work. He relies on a staff of refugees. The church became a center of Sandy recovery efforts, and Pangimanan found his calling as minister of disaster relief. Here's his pastor, Seth Capperdell.
He got very passionate about helping people in this situation. Harry would prepare the meals. Harry would collect mops and gloves and any sort of goods.
Despite his service, Pangimanan is at risk of being deported. Originally from Indonesia, he moved here about 25 years ago. He's married and has two children, both U.S. citizens.
Since my childhood, all that we watch in the TV about how great is America, and then if you're working hard, and then you can achieve your dreams.
Pangimanan arrived on a six-month visa and never left.
I'm working with my company for about 16 years, and then I have never got problems. But after the September 11, everything's changed.
That's when Pangimanan got caught up in a quirk of America's immigration laws. He's Christian, but Indonesia is a majority Muslim nation. And under a program started by President Bush, men from Muslim countries had to register with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Eventually, Pangimanan received a final order of deportation. They caught him at his house in 2009, cuffing him as his seven-year-old daughter watched.
I got no heart to hug her or say goodbye to her or anything, so I just kind of look upon her and then wave my hand.
He was released, but he fought deportation for years. At one point, he took sanctuary in Pastor Capperdell's church for 11 months. Eventually, Pangimanan won a stay on his deportation order. He had to check in with immigration officers every year, but with a work permit and no criminal record, this was a pretty straightforward process. Under President Trump, that's all changed. Last week, four Indonesian Christians from the church were given 60 days to leave the country when they showed up to check in. Again, Pastor Capperdell.
People who live in communities and aren't scary and don't have guns, and it's all the people who have made New Jersey better. It's people like Harry.
Under a Trump directive, ICE agents who deal with immigrants at these check-ins have new discretion to deport.
I would argue that it's against the agency's best interest to be doing this systematically.
John Amaya was deputy chief of staff at ICE under President Obama.
I don't think they want to be detaining individuals and bringing them in during the regular check-ins only to detain them and remove them, because then no one's going to be reporting.
Instead, immigrants will evade law enforcement. One reason those who violate immigration law are released is the government doesn't have the resources to catch, process, and deport millions of immigrants. Trump wants to expand detention centers and hire new ICE agents, but that'll take months, if not years. In the meantime, there is one thing he can do that has had an immediate effect.
I think the rhetoric is instilling fear in the community. The fear is real.
To get a sense of that fear, I go to the federal building in Newark, where immigrants line up every day to check in with ICE. At a deli down the block, I meet Mary, who has lived in the country illegally for more than 20 years. At her request, we're not using her real name. She's waiting for her husband, who's meeting with ICE and could be facing deportation.
Before, just go report, and they said come back 1 year. Now, we don't know the new rule, but we hope it's going to be okay.
Mary is not allowed to join her husband in the meeting.
Actually, feel stressful, feeling nervous. We hope everything is going to be fine, but actually is nervous. Oh, it's gone.
Just then, she gets a call from him. Everything is okay. He can stay until at least his next check-in in 2018. Mary says their four kids will be relieved. Dad is coming home. For WNYC, I'm Matt Katz.
President Donald Trump's proposed budget released today includes a 31% cut to the Environmental Protection Agency. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips joins us to talk about how that plan could impact Philadelphia and the region. Susan, start us off by shedding light on some of the details around these cuts.
Well, some of these cuts aren't surprising given the campaign rhetoric, and some have people's heads spinning. Let's start with the Chesapeake Bay. Complete elimination of funding for bay cleanup.
I don't recall that campaign platform.
No. In fact, this has been one of the most non-controversial bipartisan efforts undertaken by the EPA. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in Congress over this one. It's the playground for the Washington elite, both Democrats and Republicans. And it's been a success story. But bay advocates say the ecosystem is still very fragile and continues to suffer. especially from upstream runoffs in Pennsylvania, both agriculture and wastewater runoff.
What are some of the other surprises?
A huge cut in Superfund sites, more than half. And this is, again, a bipartisan no-brainer. States beg for this money, and Trump's own EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, has said he supports the Superfund program. But this budget proposal reads like a very political statement. The second sentence emphasizes the state's responsibility to protect the environment.
Federalism, that's the defining philosophy of Pruitt, right?
That's right. Remember, he was the attorney general in Oklahoma and spent a lot of time and money suing the EPA for what he said was regulatory overreach. Now, here's Pruitt speaking to EPA staffers the first day in his new position.
I seek to ensure that we engender the trust of those at the state level, that those at the state level see us as partners in this very important mission we have as an agency and not adversaries.
Susan, what is he referring to by adversaries?
Well, the EPA does come down on states when it feels as though they're not properly enforcing federal rules that protect clean air and clean water. But many see that as a good thing. Take a listen to Carol Collier. She used to work for the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and now runs the Watershed Program for the Academy of Natural Sciences.
EPA is always a good backup for the states. You know, sometimes because of state politics and other things, the state may not want to take an action, but they know EPA is sort of in that back room there and can take it. It's really important to have that.
So how are states reacting?
The thing is, Dave, that states rely on EPA for funding to enforce these rules. In the case of Pennsylvania, that's 30% of the Pennsylvania DEP's budget comes from the federal EPA. And Trump's proposed budget would nearly eliminate those dollars to states. Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection Secretary Patrick McDonnell today penned a letter to EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt decrying this proposal. And the EPA under Obama actually told Pennsylvania regulators recently that it wasn't doing a very good job making sure Pennsylvania residents had safe drinking water. And under this proposal, the DEP would have to slash those inspections by a third. It's sort of ironic that they're proposing this whole federalism philosophy to the states, and the states themselves, you know, really need the money to do anything. Just to give an example, it would mean little or no oversight for state sewage treatment plants, industrial wastewater discharges, or construction site runoffs. Coal mine safety, lead contamination, air pollution prevention would all see serious cuts under this budget.
Any increases?
Yes, water infrastructure. But it's pennies compared with what water experts say is needed to fix the country's aging drinking water systems.
Thanks, Susan.
You're welcome.
State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips on NewsWorks Tonight. The current debate over President Trump's immigration ban can be traced back at least 100 years. That's according to a new exhibition at the National Museum of American Jewish History. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on the year that set the course for Jews in the 20th century.
1917 was a harbinger year. That was when the United States entered World War I, when the Bolshevik Revolution promised a communist utopia in Russia, and when Britain put its weight behind a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
Three pivotal events in world history, all of which seem to point to hope, to the world transitioning into a new era.
That's Josh Perlman. He's a curator at the National Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia.
But the year ends with all of these issues quite unresolved.
Not just unresolved, but sparking a backlash against Jews in America and around the world. A disproportionate number of Jewish immigrants enlisted as U.S. soldiers during World War I, in part to better assimilate, only to find after the war a rise in anti-Semitic nationalism. In Russia, the socialist ideals of equality were upended by Joseph Stalin's Great Purge, and the British Balfour Declaration, supporting a Zionist state in Palestine, created a knot of controversy that is still tightly bound a century later. 1917, How One Year Changed the World, exhibits rare documents, photographs, and artifacts co-curated by Perlman and Rachel Lithgow of the American Jewish Historical Society in New York. Lithgow says the hopes generated by the events of 1917 were cut short 6 years later by the Johnson-Reed Act, which sharply limited the number of immigrants allowed in America.
What history showed happens by the Johnson-Reed Act is that people die when we shut our borders. I mean, there's an absolute direct correlation to what happens when the United States decides who and who isn't American and who can't become American.
Lithgow says this exhibition is directly influenced by the recent travel bans proposed by the Trump administration, which has launched exactly the same debates that were happening in 1917.
100 years is a blink of an eye.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.